A man can be an artist in anything. Food, whatever. It depends on how good he is. Junk food cinema's art is cult film appreciation, and we're about to paint our masterpiece using ketchup packets and coffee stains. But still, masterpiece. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome to Junk Food Cinema. We believe revenge, like pizza, is a dish best served cold. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film podcast that takes a tire iron to the kneecaps of irony. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined by my fellow reprobate, screenwriter, slash novelist, slash co-host, C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, everybody.
That's you.
That's me.
That is you.
And I'm very excited about today.
This is going to be a fun episode. We have not drawn a line in the sand, and I feel like today's episode is that line in the sand.
Yeah.
If that sand were made entirely of pixie stick dust.
And awesomeness.
Whatever that content is in pixie sticks.
Now, tonight we are talking about one of my favorite movies of all time that has been on my top 10 list of favorite films. Not of best films, but of favorite films for many years. And it is a film that is actually a remake of another film. And you like that other film better than I like Man on Fire.
And most people don't even know that the film you're talking about is a remake, but we will stop talking in vagaries in just a moment. And
vagaries.
What did I say? Vagaries?
Vagaries.
Vagaries in just a moment. But first, I want to let you know that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes. And in fact, we have been moving up, Cargill, I don't know if you know this, we have been moving up the new and noteworthy section of iTunes. We're now like number 35. Anyway, the point is, we're moving up, damn it. We are now on that list if you scroll down a little bit. So, guys,
we are both new and noteworthy.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're listening to this, if you like it, please go to iTunes, search for Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section, give us a 5-star rating, and leave a review. We've had quite a few great reviews over the last couple weeks, and we really appreciate
Thank
it.
In you fact, guys.
You know what? I'm going to read one right
read
now.
Read one right now.
I'm going to read one right now.
Let's suck our own dicks, everybody.
That is why we had that rib removed, goddammit. This one is actually from Slain1, who says, there aren't two better guys to call if you're looking for honest, non-ironic recommendations for what's unfortunately considered, quote, the lowbrow part of cinema by the snobby cinephiles. I can't help but stop whatever else I'm doing after listening to an episode and watch whatever films they've discussed. Thank you, Slain1. I appreciate that. We are very much anti-irony on this show.
Well, I love that people are seeking out these movies that we're talking about and digging on them. I get those. You guys tweet me every once in a while and keep those tweets coming. It makes me so happy when people discover these movies. But just a little request, if you would. If you tweet at me that you're watching it, then tweet at me whether you liked it or not. Even if you hate it, let me know. Because I get these tweets and they're like, I'm watching Battle Beyond the Stars for the first time ever. I'm like, awesome. Did you like it? And their Twitter feed is like nothing for 8 hours. It's like, but you've left me hanging. Did you actually like it?
Maybe they're watching it multiple times. We don't know.
Which
sure.
or maybe they turned it off 5 minutes in and said, fuck those guys, I'm going to hang myself after a Drano cocktail. I don't know.
All we can do is be honest with the movies that we love, guys. That's all we can really do. But in addition to iTunes, we're also available on Stitcher, which is a thing that exists, so you can find us there as well. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, and definitely check us out every week on Film School Rejects. So that's all the housekeeping stuff. And now, today, we're going to do something we haven't done before. We're going to talk about two cinematic versions of a single story. And I know that film critics, by and large, tend to poo-poo on remakes just de facto. It's like, if it's a remake, it must be terrible.
We were just talking about this earlier tonight and talking about how great Wages of Fear is, but how awesome Sorcerer is.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's not what we're talking about.
But that's not what we're talking about today on the show. We were just sitting around drinking, talking movies.
That's way too highbrow for this particular episode. So
highbrow, dude, we are talking about one of my favorite films of all time here.
Yes, but we're talking about one of your favorite films of all time. So I don't think highbrow is automatically. I'm just saying it's not automatically inferred that it'll be highbrow.
This is the foot we're starting out on tonight. This is going
to
be.
I'm just saying, man. You will be the first to admit that your favorite movies aren't necessarily the highbrow picks.
Not all
I will
of them.
Say the same thing as well.
Yeah.
That is the reason this show exists.
Yeah.
Highbrow is not necessarily an adjective we look for in our favorite movies.
No, we just look for them to be awesome. Like tonight's films.
Yes.
Both of them, and let's say this right now, we like both of these movies a lot, but we just happen to think one version is better than the other, and one of us happens to be right, and then there's Brian.
Oh, we're going to do this now? All right.
No, we're not going to do this.
So this is the battle royale.
One of us had to make that joke at some point.
The gauntlet's been thrown down by my Sir Lancelot looking motherfucking co-host over here. So we're going to examine both the 1987
Sir Likes a Lot,
the 1987 and 2004 versions of Man on Fire. That's right, guys. Tony Scott's Man on Fire is a remake.
It is a remake, and it's a remake of a Scott Glenn movie.
Yep. It's you know, remakes get a lot of flack by their very nature, but hopefully our comparative discussion can shake out the strengths of the original and also of those elements of Tony Scott's Man on Fire that make it superior to its predecessor. That is me being deferential, motherfucker.
All right.
So if you remember the 2004 version of Man on Fire, you know that his name is
Denzel Washington.
Denzel Washington. Wow, okay. That's a name to remember. Okay, so Denzel Washington plays Creasy, who is this sort of former special ops guy who was hired to be the bodyguard of a young girl who's living in Mexico. And Mexico, as we know, is like Mos Eisley to the power of 1,000, the wretched hive of scum and villainy where kidnappings happen every couple
Mexico
hours.
Mexico City.
So,
and which is genuinely true.
I'm not saying that about the movie. I'm saying that about Mexico City.
Yeah, it is in fact, there's a couple great documentaries on just how bad it is down there. That it really is. It's become a cottage industry of figuring out exactly who to kidnap and how to kidnap them and how to go about it. And this movie played upon that and, you know, altered the setting from the original film and ends up really making Mexico City a character in this movie.
Yeah. And the thing most people don't know is that Man on Fire is actually a remake of a 1987 film starring Scott Glenn in the Denzel Washington role of Creasy. And this is based on a novel by A.J. Quinnell, who actually wrote Creasy into a number of novels. He was a character that ran through a number of different novels. He was a former French Foreign Legion character, a guy who was very broken and very at the end of his rope, an alcoholic, just completely broken down human being, and kind of gets recommended by a friend for this sort of last effort, this job that represents his last chance to stand on his own two feet.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Tony Scott's film, Denzel Washington plays that role, you know, magnificently. But it's not the only version of that role that exists. And again, this is something that most people don't know because the 1987 Man on Fire, which was directed by a French director named a director whose name I can't pronounce, Eli Chiraki. I'm going to butcher that name. Sorry, guys. Stars Scott Glenn as Creasy, and it's a very different feel, a very different just sort of texture that story.
And it's a French director with a Italian produced film.
Yes.
And set in Italy.
Well, the only place that has more kidnappings than Mexico City is Italy, apparently. So this is a geography lesson that I'm getting, you know, watching both of these films. And Cargill and I sat down and watched both versions recently.
Now, here's the important thing to note. One of the reasons why most people don't know this film is it's kind of got a dubious distribution history and was never released on DVD. You can only find it on VHS. There might be foreign versions out there, but we haven't found any yet.
No, we haven't. So, yeah, the version that I own is a VHS copy.
And it's weird because it's called Man on Fire on the cover, but what was the title card that came up? It was like Without Mercy. Yeah, so like we're watching this movie in a box that says Man on Fire, and in classic, you know, in classic form, it's got a completely different title card when it comes out. It's like Without Mercy, and I'm like, dude, did you put in the right tape? And he's like, no. And there's Scott Glenn. It's like, okay, this is Man on Fire. You know, I had seen it years ago, but had totally forgotten that I'd seen it. And had found out about it, but couldn't find it anywhere. And when we started talking about doing this episode, Brian was like, oh, wait, I've got that on VHS. Let's watch that. And so we watched them back to back.
So this is basically how this episode is going to break down, is that we're going to talk about the two different versions, because Cargill is a huge fan of the remake, and I'm a big fan of the original. And having watched them back to back, I still maintain that I enjoy the original more than the remake, whereas Cargill was very vice versa on that. So Cargill, I'm gonna start with you. I'm gonna start with you in the 2004 version that most people know. So tell me what it is about the remake that really strikes your fancy as much as it clearly does.
Well, I think that the greatest difference between the two films, and there's a lot of differences, but the greatest difference and the most interesting difference is in the presentation of Creasy. And in the 87 version, Creasy is haunted by his failures in the past and his inability to have saved a child, in some backstory that is only hinted at. In the 2004 version, Creasy's haunted by his success. He was really good at what he did, and he did a lot of horrible things.
Much like Wolverine.
Yes.
What I do is not pretty, but I'm the best at it.
I'm the best at what I do. But that's who Creasy is, and Creasy is this guy who's done all this dark shit, and it's finally all caught up to him and weighed down on him, and he just can't take it anymore, and he can't get through the day anymore, and he wants to put a bullet in his head and end it all, but he's got this good friend, played by Christopher Walken, who sets him up with a cakewalk job. He's like, look, this is cake. You're doing good work. It's easy. And you could do this in your sleep. And it's just, it's literally, you know, playing wet nurse to this 8-year-old girl played by, Dakota Fanning. And he's just got to drive her to and from school every day and take care of her while her parents are bopping around the world as being, you know, rich people. And so he gets involved. He wants nothing to do with this little girl. And then we have this amazing first act that is the bonding of, the creation of a father-daughter friendship relationship that's really fantastic and really, really well handled. And by the end of that first act, you just, you know, this girl has given this guy a reason to live again. And he's getting back on his feet. Everything's going. And then she gets stolen and his world goes dark. And a switch flips, and he just goes to town being an evil, evil motherfucker to these people with the sole goal of getting this girl back. And he is relentless, and he is uncaring, and he just cuts a swath of bloody murder throughout Mexico City trying to get her back, which is a stark comparison to what happens in the first film, which is Creasy is he's not bad at what he does, but when it comes time for trying to get her back, he doesn't really know much of what to do. He knows enough of what to do to find the girl, but his plan isn't quite so effective or daring or violent or hints enough at that he is as competent as his alterniverse version of him is. And so I find that dark, haunted Creasy really fascinating. I love watching him deal with all these evil motherfuckers and not cut them a bit of slack and kind of turn the tables. Because we've seen just how far these people are willing to go, and they've just fucked with somebody who will go even farther than they would. And I love that interesting take on the story.
Well, and it's funny to me that you say that, because frankly, the thing I like, and I'll grant you this. There is nothing less violent or less ruthless about Creasy in the original. It's just less spectacular. And I think the thing that Tony Scott does that really does improve upon the original film is that he makes Creasy such a force of nature in the grand cinematic sense. Like, there's nothing that Creasy does in the original that you would look at and go, oh, well, that guy's kind of a pussy. He's definitely violent. He's definitely has, you know, he's cruel and he's direct and to the point, very much the way that we would want him to be, just not quite as spectacularly as he is in the remake. But the thing that I like better about Creasy in the original, frankly, is that the book describes him as an alcoholic and a burnout. And when I revisited the remake, I don't get that from Denzel Washington. Denzel Washington, yeah, clearly he drinks. He makes several references to the fact that, yeah, I drink. But he's still super charming. He is still every bit a movie star. And while I'm not faulting Denzel Washington for that, it doesn't ring as true for me as for Creasy as Scott Glenn does. Because when Scott Glenn comes onto the screen, he is clearly burnt out.
Oh, dude, he looks like your washed up uncle that comes and sleeps on your couch.
He looks like 40 miles of bad road. You know, if I can borrow a line from Paris, Texas, he literally looks like a burnout. And it's not just a look thing. Like, you know, Denzel, God love him with his like 5 o'clock shadow and his stubble beard. It's like that's how they communicate that he's burnt out. And I'm like, I'm sorry. He is still and throughout the whole opening of the film, when he's hanging out with Christopher Walken, he still has all his faculty. Christopher Walken.
Christopher Walken.
I don't know why I said it like that, but I did. He's still got all his faculties about him. He's even as a drunk, he is still every bit on top of his game. And while that's a great thing for Denzel Washington, I feel like it's a complete step backwards for the character of Creasy. Whereas Scott Glenn really does portray that completely washed up, burnout, former badass. And, you know, that is one thing automatically. And it's – I will say this. I will in complete deference to the remake, I think there are very few things that the original does better. But I definitely think the character of Creasy initially is portrayed better by Scott Glenn than it is by Denzel Washington, because Denzel Washington – is still that movie star.
Yeah, but I like that rather than being a drunk burnout, he's presented more as just being haunted. Like he's somebody that's having a very hard time dealing with the shit that he's done. And I find that to be much more compelling a character than a guy who just failed at his job and as a result fell to the bottle and keeps his distance from everybody. I find that story element much more compelling.
Right, but they still present Denzel Washington as an alcoholic burnout. They try to by having him say so many times in the film, I drink, drinking is a problem for me. And yet every time he does it, I don't get the sense that it impedes his work whatsoever. So it doesn't ring as true for me, even though they're trying to kind of have their cake and eat it too with him being a super, camera-friendly movie star. And yet they're also trying to portray him as this alcoholic. And it's like, yeah, we see him drink, but he's still like ridiculously charming. He never seems to be out of control of his faculties.
Well, but everybody in the movie finds Creasy charming as well in the original.
Well,
I mean, it's...
Yeah, but he's not,
nobody's
though.
Like... Nobody's... Well, I don't know. Scott Glenn is a charming motherfucker.
I mean, that's because we both love The Keep. Let's be real. Well, like, this is all based on our mutual love of The Keep.
No. Let's be honest. I'm a huge Scott Glenn fan for a number of films that aren't just The Keep. Scott Glenn is a really talented actor.
But it's The Keep.
Dude, I look at him. I don't see The Keep. I see Silence of the Lambs.
He's in that movie for like 5 minutes.
And yet he owns that fucking movie.
I'm sorry,
for five
Naked
minutes.
Yoga in The Keep trumps Jack Crawford for 5 minutes in Silence of the Lambs. I mean, there's a conversion chart in the back of every notebook that says that. I don't know what to tell you.
But don't get me wrong. I love so many things about Scott Glenn. And so Scott Glenn or Denzel, both it's one of the things is both leading men are amazing. And they both do a great job in the film. And you can't take any of that away. That's why I didn't say Denzel does a better job with Creasy than Scott Glenn does. No, the story elements are what I find, you know, the story element in that is what I find compelling. But I just want to. As we're talking about this, I there's something that keeps tugging at me that I have to mention before we go on. So the Christopher Walken role in the 2004 version, who plays him in the 1987 version?
Hold on. Hey, okay. It's Joe Pesci.
It's Joe Pesci. So they replaced Joe Pesci with Christopher Walken, which is kind of fucking awesome because
I mean it's kind of a lateral move if you think about the gangster genre.
It really is. They've done scenes together, haven't they?
Yeah,
they
have, and they've done enough. You know, they've done an equivalent amount of gangster movies individually.
Yeah,
that it literally is a lateral move.
Yeah. So now they're both special ops guys living in other countries.
Yeah.
And you buy it.
You move from Tommy from Goodfellas to the King of New York. It's like, okay,
this is another one of those things where the differences I love. like, you know, Christopher Walken, as we as you famously mentioned one time, is in this movie. He's not just playing that character. He's also playing Colonel Troutman.
Yeah, he and is the Colonel Troutman
his,
of that film.
His job is to sit and give a Christopher Walken-esque speech that defines Creasy. It's like, okay, who's this guy? He is a master painter.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, if Creasy's, he really is like this Troutman speech in First Blood, where he says like, you don't want to seem to address the fact you're dealing with an expert, with a man who's been trained to ignore pain. Like, he is giving that speech. Yeah. And he's like, you know, every man has an art form.
Creasy's art is death. He's about to paint his masterpiece.
I expected that speech to end with him telling, you know, the Mexican government.
Watch.
Yeah, the Mexican government, like, you need to bring a healthy supply of body bags. Yeah.
I've seen a lot of body bags. I've never pictured myself inside one.
Yeah, no, it's a really, and he's really great in it. He does it in the true Christopher Walken sense, that you will stare at Christopher Walken that whole time, buying into this speech and believing every word. But Pesci's version, he's just playing that guy who's just kind of, he's a little over the hill. He's really good at what he does. He knows his job, but he's just kind of like settling in. He's taking a cush job. And I think Pesci sells that better than Walken does, because that's exactly what Walken's doing. He's like, look, you know, there's so much work for us down in Mexico. They're paying a lot of money to do no fucking work at all.
Which is actually a weird parallel to Walken's actual career, because it's almost like Walken going, well, you know, look, there's this role for me, this supporting role in a Tony Scott film. I'm going to milk it for all it's worth, like I do every role I possibly do. Whereas, God love him, for the first time in his career, Pesci is actually subdued in his role in the 87 Man of Fire.
No, he's this, you totally buy him as this guy who's just taking, you know, cakewalk jobs, you know, that are just so much easier than the crazy shit he used to do in his youth. And you buy that. And like, there's the scenes where he gets on the phone and he's like, yeah, what's the problem now? What is this? You know, getting married, you know, it's really two interesting portrayals of the same guy. And Christopher Walken's is much more bigger than life. But yeah, Pesci's is actually much more down to earth and more realistic. And I would say that's the interesting dichotomy of these two films, is that the original Man on Fire feels at most points like a film rooted in reality. And the 2004 Man on Fire is a film very much rooted in a cinematic universe.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting. Like, I was going to compare it. Like, initially I thought that, you know, a feather in the cap of the original was its cast. But I'm looking at these two, you know, side by side. And, you know, the original has Scott Glenn, has Joe Pesci, has Danny Aiello, and Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, Jonathan Pryce trumps Mark Anthony. That's an easy decision to make. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But that being said, the remake has Dakota Fanning, Rada Mitchell, and in Mickey Rourke, and in a seeming reference to the original, Giancarlo Giannini.
Huh?
There is no reason Giancarlo Giannini should be in Mexico. He is the most Italian actor of all the Italian actors, and yet he's in the Mexican version of Man on Fire.
Well, here's an interesting piece of trivia that you dug up that is really interesting for this, is the fact that Tony Scott was actually trying to get this movie back in 87, and the studio balked.
Yeah, it was, and this is where this whole like debate that we're having becomes null and void, is that Tony Scott was supposed to direct the original version of this movie, and he had not done enough that the studio felt comfortable giving him a film, which is ridiculous to me, because the guy they ended up giving it to, I couldn't tell you another one of his films. Like, I went through his catalog, and I couldn't tell you what another, because they're in Italian.
Yeah, so while that movie was being made, he just went off and made things like Top Gun and Days of Thunder.
Yeah, it's fucking bombs, like those movies, right? Yeah, no.
And there's an alternate universe out there.
Yes.
If you believe in alternate universe theories, where instead of Top Gun and Days of Thunder, we got
Man on Fire
by Tony Scott in 1987.
But who would have played Creasy in 87? Because it wouldn't have been Denzel Washington.
No, it probably would have been Scott Glenn again, unless it was really, you know, unless in that alternate universe, Tony Scott would be like, no, I believe in this kid, you know, he's...
Oh, don't say it. I know what you're going to say. Don't say it.
He made like three fucking movies with the guy.
Don't say Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise. I'm not saying that's the best choice. I'm saying that the Tony Scott of that era of the 1985, 86, 87 may have gone with Tom Cruise in a 1987, Italian set.
I can't say that you're wrong. I just don't want to imagine a universe in which that is true.
But Tom Cruise back then was badass and hungry. He might have done an interesting job, or maybe he would have looked at him and said, "No, he's just too young."
Yeah.
You know, Creasy. You know, Creasy can't be young. And then he would go with somebody, you know, different. And maybe instead of Pesci, he would have gone back and worked with David Bowie and had David Bowie
It's funny though. It's funny because in 1995, he works with Denzel on Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Tony Scott worked with, in fact, that was one of the things when he passed. One of the things that was mentioned and went around was there's no other mainstream white director that has made so many films with a black lead as Tony Scott was. And Tony Scott had no problems and always had no problems casting a black actor in what was written to be a white role at all. And made amazing fucking movies out
of it. And in that regard, I will give you three other possibilities. The first one being, you know, because he directed Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yeah.
Suddenly Eddie Murphy becomes, I'm just saying, based on what you just said.
Yeah. No.
But no, yeah. He was every bit as young as Tom Cruise at the point.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's what changed my mind on Tom Cruise, that it might not have been Tom Cruise.
But
yeah, if
it's not Eddie Murphy, what if it's Michael Ironside, who he worked with in Top Gun? Can you imagine? Because I'm kind of frothing at the mouth at the idea.
Oh, Michael Ironside.
Of a Michael Ironside. He worked with Michael Ironside in Top Gun. So now I'm just thinking about a Michael Ironside Creasy in the original Man on Fire.
But Michael Ironside would be better cast as the as in the Joe Pesci role.
Yeah.
Michael Ironside would have been great in that role, too.
Possibly. So
enough of the alternate universe.
What the fuck are we talking about?
Yeah. What we're talking about is an alternate universe version. We're talking about three versions of Man on Fire.
Yeah. Well, here's the big hang-up, I think, about the original Man on Fire and why I'm not going to rally even the few people who are listening to this who will actually get a chance to see this on VHS who are not going to rally to my side for this reason is that the original Man on Fire is a super gritty, powerfully cinematic film that is something that I don't think comes through terribly well watching the VHS.
Yeah, it really is a film that you don't want to see full screen because it is. There's a lot of slow-mo cinematography. It's that very 80s blown out kind of light look. There's that great there's an opening sequence where we're tracking through a hospital and there the wind's coming in through the windows and blowing the gauze around the hospital beds and in slow motion and the doctors are walking through. And we track up on a body bag and it's just, it's one of those things that it's in that era that John Woo was working. So it looks very much like an early Woo film in everything but the action sequences. I would hesitate to compare it too strong.
No.
But the emotional setups are very much like John Woo's melodrama. And it's very cinematic. It's very beautiful to look at. And it's really cool.
And, you know, it's funny you mentioned John Woo because, frankly, I think it's got sort of a Michael Mann quality to it. It's, it's got that sympathy for the devil, beautiful blue-lit night shots, and an authenticity that makes it seem as if some of the actors are real criminals, which, frankly, given the extensive research that A.J. Quinnell did for his books, makes sense because he actually, talked with anti-mafia agents, and he lived in some of the farthest flung corners of the world. At certain points in his life, he lived in Africa, he lived in Bangkok. Like, A.J. Quinnell is a guy that's lived everywhere, man, to quote Johnny Cash. So there's a lot of elements of the film that feel very Michael Mann to me. But again, the problem is that there's not a good transfer of the film. There's not a good DVD, and God knows, not a good Blu-ray transfer of this film. So the only way you get to see it is this really sort of limited VHS. And by limited, I mean artistically. Like the transfer of the film on VHS is very, slimmed down, and it's very blocked off, and you just don't get a full sense of the cinematic nature of the movie.
Yeah, I kind of wish there was a 10th anniversary Man on Fire Blu-ray that came with the original.
That would have been
cleaned
cool.
up. That would have been awesome. Yeah, no, it's one of those sad films that just has been forgotten. And there's a lot of good to it. As much as I prefer the 2004, I really like the 87. I mean, it's much slower. The pacing is off a bit.
The pacing is problematic.
And I will
admit that freely. The pacing is going to lose a lot of people.
But the character work is great. The relationship between Scott Glenn and the girl really does. It's what's interesting is that it hits all of the same beats in the movie. And there are several similar scenes, but they're all executed in very different ways, right down to like the finger cutting scene, mm-hmm. which happens in a car in Man on Fire and happens in a gay porn stall bathroom. In the original.
You should just say 2004 or 1987.
Yeah.
Because they're both Man on Fire.
They're both Man on Fire. But the relationship between Creasy and the girl is different, but it's father-daughter in a very different way. They become their relationship is much warmer, and much warmer from the get-go in the way they handle that. Wait,
in which version?
In the 87 version.
Okay.
And it's, whereas, you know,
we have to be very careful.
Yeah.
It's a pronoun in the, antecedent.
In the 2004 version, you know, I like that relationship. I think it's stronger, but they take more time to develop it, and I feel that it's really earned. But by the end, it's warm, but it's warm in a father-daughter kind of authoritarian. I'm the alpha male, and you are a daughter who's finally having a real parent in their life, and love me for that. And he's teaching her discipline, and I particularly love the scenes where, you know, in the 2004, where Creasy is realizes that she's afraid of the gun, and mm-hmm. that the starting gun is costing her time on the block. Because in the 2004, she's a swimmer. In the 87, she's a track.
Yeah,
she's a runner.
Both of which have starting guns, by the way.
Yes, and I love the whole notion of him teaching her not to be afraid and to just go, and how Tony Scott brilliantly works that into the scene where she gets kidnapped. And it's just all of that.
That is a nice crossover.
Yeah, he, you know, because Tony Scott's one of my favorite directors. And I think that he never got as much play and as much respect from the critical base because he was making mainstream movies. But he was making really smart mainstream movies and making films much smarter than the audience realized they were getting until they got there. And he made very few clunkers, and almost all of his films are great. And there's so much smart stuff woven into this movie. And I've watched this movie so many times. I love the 2004 Man on Fire with a passion. And I love how that there's that very slow, very protracted developing of this relationship. So we really care, and we see why Creasy breaks. And that doesn't totally, it doesn't work as well in the 87, but it's a much warmer, much friendlier father-daughter relationship that really, that has a couple of really great scenes that really, that work almost as well. And that work in very different ways. I love that both of these films are the same story, but they're two very different takes on how to tell it.
I feel like I almost feel like the reason that the father-daughter relationship works better in the 2004 is because of the weakness of the performance of Mark Anthony. Because frankly, in the 87 version, it is never intended to be a father-daughter relationship. In fact, the relationship is routinely and repeatedly compared to the relationship between Lenny and George. It's a much more of a protector relationship. It's not something as visceral as a father-daughter. It's not something as biologically binding as father and daughter. It's much more of a protector-type relationship, and that's what comes through entirely in the original. And I think that's because Jonathan Pryce does such a great job of playing that father role, whereas Mark Anthony, you know, God love him, is not a great actor.
No, but
he does his best with that role, but it's like that's...
But Pryce has so little screen time. That's not... Their bond doesn't really come from Pryce. Their bond really comes from those scenes in particular where they're talking about the book, you know, because that's her favorite book, and she's really... really, she sees, in, the reason why they connect is she sees in Creasy someone else who's been forgotten by everyone else and that no one else gives a shit about, and feels like, this is somebody who could give a shit about me, who I could give a shit about. And, right. and I love that aspect of how that bond grows. And that's what I was talking about in What's Different, is they really do a good job of cementing that friendship, but it does turn into a father-daughter relationship.
I felt like there is a very different relationship struck between Creasy and PETA in the original than there is in the remake. And I feel like one of the things that makes the original so strong is that it's not necessarily just an easy father-daughter relationship. It's something that's a lot more complicated and a lot more sort of just in that sort of perpetual protector type role. And, you know, I agree that the narration in the original is problematic, and I feel like it was there to give this sort of extra layer of noir to the story, but it ends up over-explaining obvious story beats to the point that the audience isn't trusted to see things right in front of them.
And so, this is once upon a time. After the Nam, after South America, after Beirut. The once upon a time when all I wanted was to blot out the nightmares.
One of the other big things is I like the ending of the 2004 Man on Fire much better than the 87.
Should we spoil?
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like you should watch both versions before you listen to this show, because we're about to spoil both endings right now.
But I so if you haven't watched it yet and you're like, oh, I've got to see these, but they end totally differently. And here's how they end differently. In the 2004, Denzel Washington sacrifices his life and ends up dying.
He trades his life for hers.
He trades his life for hers, and he ends up dying for her. In the 87, you think that he's died for her, but he actually survives, and they pretend that he's dead and set him up with a new identity, and he goes off to live happily ever after with a new identity. And personally, I feel that Creasy sacrificing his life is the only version of that story that's really great, because we've gone through this entire ordeal where he feels that he's got nothing to live for. He finally has something to live for, but the only way he can protect her is by sacrificing his life. So of course he's going to give his life for her. And Tony Scott feels that the best happy ending that he can give us is to have the girl, live. And what's so brilliant about it is you think she's dead for so long. The first half of the second act of the film is him thinking she's gone. And so he goes around killing everyone for revenge.
It's a revenge film, yeah.
And then he finds out she's still alive, and the third act is all about him trying to get her back. And so what we end up with is, you know, this great arc of this character who ultimately at the end has made everyone pay for what they've done and ends up dying to save the one thing that he found in this life that was worth loving. And it's such a beautiful, perfect, tragic, awesome ending. And it's uplifting despite its tragic nature. And I absolutely love that about the film. It's why it's one of my favorite movies, is that, in, you know, it's very hard to make a movie in which you kill off your protagonist and then have you still feel awesome at the end of it. And Man on Fire is one of those movies that lets you do that. You really do feel that it's a triumph and that Creasy has in fact painted his masterpiece.
Well, and unfortunately the difference here is that Tony Scott had the luxury of doing a one-and-done Creasy story. When the original was made, they were trying to promote this as a franchise, and the book does not end with Creasy sacrificing his life.
Yeah.
It ends very much the way the 87 version does. So the 87 version is actually way more true to the book, because the book, Man on Fire, is not the last Creasy story. It goes on for several more.
You lie! Man on Fire is the last Creasy story. There are no other Creasy stories.
I don't lie, actually.
There are no cinematic Creasy stories.
You can stick your fingers in your ears all you want,
stick grenades up your ass, whatever
you want to do. The point being,
I am going to cut your fingers off and seal them up with a cigarette lighter, motherfucker.
The point being that
that got weird.
Yeah, it did get weird.
That got really weird.
It did. The 87 version ends the way the book does. And I will agree with you that the stronger ending is in the Tony Scott film, but I can't fault the original for the way that it ended, because one, that is how the book ended, and two, they really did think at the time that they were going to be able to spin an entire franchise out of this. Unfortunately, audiences did not agree. At the time that it came out, it was not... I mean, critics lambasted the hell out of this movie. And in fact, because of that, Quinnell said that the film was, quote, so bad it became a cult movie in a European country. H.G. Quinnell, who was very aware of different cinematic cultures in different continents,
it's
said...
It's not a bad movie.
I don't agree that it's bad, but I think it's funny that the author of the book said it was so bad it became a cult movie in a European country, because clearly he understands that European markets are vastly different from American audiences.
It reminds me of my favorite, one of my favorite critical slams of all time, which came from Richard Roper when he was talking about Death to Smooch. He said it was a film so brilliant. It was a film so terrible. He was waiting for the French to announce its genius.
I kind of think that movie's genius. I'm not French at all, and yeah, I kind of think that movie's genius.
You know what? We should probably do an episode on Death to Smooch.
Oh, we will.
Because you and I both feel that we both have a sick love for that movie
yeah.
that very few other people share with us, so may have to do that at some
yeah,
point.
Yeah, definitely.
But this is not Death to Smooch. This is death to everyone that kidnapped a little girl.
Man on fucking fire. And I will again admit that the pacing of the original is tasking. I mean, it very much, like its protagonist, limps along at points, and... The thing is, I honestly think that's in service of delving deeper into Creasy's psyche and not just being a standard revenge film, but I know that it's chief among the complaints of most people that see this film. I will completely submit that. But I think if you can buy into it and if you can just lend a little bit of patience to it, I really do think that it has a lot of brilliant subtext going on, and it really gets into the heart of who Creasy is in a way that isn't as focused as Tony Scott is on being uber cinematic. And my problem with Tony Scott in this film, but in a lot of his movies, frankly, is that it has sort of a music video mentality at points where it's just like, you know, it's cut, and he does all these very stylistic things that I think actually diffuse some of the drama. There's a great discussion that goes on between in both versions, this great discussion that goes on between PETA and Creasy about the nature of their relationship. I'm not your friend. I'm not paid to be your friend. I'm paid to protect you. And then she reacts to that. She rebels against that. In both movies, these are great and important scenes. In Tony Scott's version, it's edited so much that I'm just like, I can't even, like, I know what this scene is actually about, and I can't even stay with it because you're just all over the place. It's sort of like a cinematic ADD thing going on. But again, that's just something that I feel like I get from a lot of different Tony Scott films.
Well, that's a really important point about Tony Scott and Tony Scott's work. Tony Scott was someone who was always pushing the cutting edge of cinema. He would, when he wasn't making films, he would take commercials and music videos so that he could get paid to play around with new techniques and, you know, just new lighting configurations, you know, new editing techniques. And his entire career is marked by films that were just 5 minutes ahead of their time, you know, right all the way back to The Hunger. You know, he was constantly making these amazing choices. And doing interesting stuff. Not all that worked and not all that stuck. In fact, I when I was writing a review of his work, like 10 years ago, I was highlighting the fact that that's one of the downfalls to Tony Scott and why I think critics don't look so fondly back on him is that he has such a distinctive feel that is so, you know, just on the bleeding edge of cinema that all of his films feel dated because they all feel exactly like the time that they're from, because he sometimes, you know, he plays around with it so much that people feel he overdoes it. And I definitely get that from Man on Fire. There's one scene in particular that I think everyone's kind of on the nose about, which is the one where he's sitting there with the gun and the bullet and Nine Inch Nails starts playing and it gets very jittery.
Sure.
And that one. But I love everything else. One of the interesting things is I know for a fact that from a couple of people who have worked with or know Jim Cameron, that Cameron often references Tony Scott in the fact that Tony Scott, he loves making fun of the fact that Tony Scott used 300 millimeter lenses and just always was using 300 millimeter lenses. And it's a very interesting aspect to his work of just the lens he uses.
He's that aspect.
The shots that he gets. Because he does use these, you know, these really, really just wide fucking lenses. Mm. But yeah, he was very stylish. He was very stylistic. And sometimes that doesn't play well with everybody. I love the nature, that nature of him. It's one of the reasons I'm such a huge fan of his. Not only is he a great storyteller, but he's always playing around with cinema and trying to get really interesting storytelling techniques out of the visuals.
And there's one moment in the 2004 Man on Fire that just strikes me as odd. And it's one of those situations where I end up playing this game called Which Brother Did It First? Because it's this slow motion sequence where you see the mother, played by Rhonda Mitchell, you know, the mother character of PETA after the kidnapping, and they go to that tribal singing. Yeah. And I'm like, which of the Scott brothers used that first? Because it also shows up in Gladiator, and it's something that I've come to define Ridley Scott for, but here it is showing up in a Tony Scott movie. So I'm not sure which one of the Scott brothers uses it first.
Well, but they
it's kind of annoying.
They both produced each other's movies. They work together all the time.
Scott Free.
Yeah. So, which is a great production company too.
It absolutely is.
They churned out some really, really cool movies and TV shows. And, but yeah, it's, yeah, I don't, I, you know, I think that might've been one of Ridley's things first, but usually who did it first, it was usually Tony. Mm-hmm. Because Tony was the guy who was always really playing around with this stuff and would go back to his brother and go, hey, check this out. His brother would go, oh, that's awesome. I've got to try that. And because they really did have some very similar sensibilities despite the fact that they made very different films.
Yeah.
And the thing is, and this is what kills me, is Ridley is the respected by critics brother. And Tony, everybody treats as, you know, kind of the retarded brother. And
it's that's unfair.
Well, yeah, and they're both amazing filmmakers in their own right, and the fact that they're brothers is the only reason why they get that comparison. Otherwise, they make very different films that are both awesome. But Tony Scott does such great work, and here it's just I feel that this is one of his best films, and I think it's one of those films that 20, 30 years from now people will still go back and watch and fall in love with because it's just such a great movie.
I think ironically, you know, based on what we're talking about, a lot of the backlash against Tony Scott has been his future collaborations with Denzel Washington. Deja Vu, yeah. Taking a Pelham 1, 2, 3, and Unstoppable. These are all terrible movies.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Deja Vu is not a terrible movie. Unstoppable is not terrible.
Unstoppable is terrible. No, I'm sorry. Terrible. And you have a movie that could be completely circumvented by, hold on, let me reach out and done. Let me just reach and pull the brake. Okay, and over. The beginning of that movie is literally, oh, wait, come back, train. I don't – hold on.
Except that it's based on a true story because it really happened.
That's great. It's a stupid true story. It is a true story of idiocy that does not need to be, like, celebrated in cinematic form. It is the dumbest – like,
it's
literally
not the dumbest fucking movie.
The impetus of that story is, hold on, oh, come back, train. I don't know. If I just ran a little bit quicker, I could stop this whole thing.
But I'll back you up on Taking Pelham 1, 2, 3. That's a really good movie for the first two acts, and then the third act is really bad.
Well, and it has that – and unfortunately, you know, based – you know, very – akin to what we're talking about right now, is that's a remake of a film that doesn't work because that original film is so amazing.
Yes.
And it just.
But Deja Vu's fucking good.
You can say that all you want. And
I will say it a lot. Deja Vu is fucking good. We're going to, you know what? We got to do an episode on Deja
Crimson Vu. Tide, I will give you 100%. That is a great movie with Denzel Washington.
It's an amazing movie with Denzel Washington.
All the Denzel Washington adaptations and collaborations after that, I'm not sure about. Well, I guess Man on Fire was after Crimson Tide, but you get my point. You get the drift here. But yeah, I mean, ultimately where we land on this is that both versions have something interesting to bring to the table, and that it's one of those situations where you can't shit on a remake for existing, and you also can't necessarily say that the remake is leaps and bounds better than the original. It just, there are certain things that it does better, there are certain things that the original does better, but both versions definitely warrant viewing, and I think warrant viewing back to back.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those things that you should marathon one after the other to really understand and appreciate the stylistic differences from one to the next.
And how they tell the same story two very different ways.
Yeah.
I mean, just everything about those stories, it's just done differently. And I prefer the 2004, but start with the 87 and then move to the 2004 and you can enjoy it. It's well worth tracking down this VHS if you can find it. Or did you manage to find it online?
I haven't yet. I will keep looking, but I haven't been able to find a version. But you know what? I say potato, you say grenade up some guy's ass.
Yeah. Yeah, grenade up some guy's ass is pretty great. I approve of this message. I mean, it's I love everything about the I love everything but one moment. There's one moment in the 2004 I do not like.
What's that?
And that's what it goes back to what you opened up this this episode with, the moment where Denzel Washington says, "Revenge is a dish best served cold." And it's like, motherfucker, it doesn't get hotter than what you're doing. This is, it doesn't mean revenge is a dish best served with malice. It's the quote means revenge is a dish best served long after everyone's forgotten they've even done it. And you come back and fuck them up and they have no idea why you're fucking them up. This is not what you're doing. Everyone knows why you're coming and why you're doing it. And you are fucking seething and still pissed. And the girl is still alive and not even back. It could not be hotter than this.
Ladies
and
gentlemen,
one problem with the movie.
This is what happens when you misattribute a Klingon proverb, and that is what we have proven definitively on this episode.
Yeah. No, that's and see, that's the thing, is Wrath of Khan did it, and Wrath of Khan owns it, and if you're not going to do it better than Wrath of Khan, you don't fucking borrow from Wrath of Khan. Although, really, it goes back much further than Wrath of Khan, because they were misattributing the quote.
Nope.
That was
Klingon proverb. Nope. Klingon proverb.
That's the joke of Klingon proverb, motherfucker.
I'm going to take your family apart piece by piece. You understand me? Piece by piece.
So for this week's junk food tie-in, I actually struggled with this a lot. I mean, you could go fireball route. You could go fireball whiskey route, since we drink during these podcasts. There's a lot
occasionally.
Occasionally. There's a lot of different ways you can go. But watching these two movies kind of reminds me of visiting two different but both quality Chinese buffets. And even when you are making the same dish from one restaurant to the other, the taste can be quite different. And one of the key differences in taste from Chinese restaurant to Chinese food restaurant is often spiciness. So you have to determine for yourself to what level you would like your taste buds to be set on fire. And that is entirely the reason that I am going with this junk food pairing.
Really? You couldn't go with Frito Pie Pasta Bowl?
No, because that's horrible. No, because I like both these movies.
I actually
like both these movies. I wouldn't eat that to save my life.
Frito Pie Pasta Bowl? What's wrong with the Frito Pie Pasta Bowl?
You just explained it.
I just mixed Mexican and Italian together.
I wish you had more time.
We'll strike this episode off your hit list because we are laying it to rest. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been the weirdest comparative discussion of an original and a remake I think ever broadcast on the internet. But hey, that's what you get when you listen to Junk Food Cinema. I want to remind you once again that we are available on iTunes. Please go there, search for Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section, leave a 5-star rating, and give us a review. You can also find us on Stitcher and on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, Facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema if you want to like us there. Cargill, where can we find you online?
Well, online you can find me at Facebook.com/MassaWorm or at on Twitter at Twitter.com/MassaWorm. I also have a new novel coming out next month, Queen of the Dark Things, on May 13th. You can get the first book in that series, Dreams and Shadows, wherever you find your books.
How novel of you to bring that up. And I am, you can find me, I'm sorry, man. It's very late.
Do you realize there are people actually listening to this that had to suffer through that?
Are there really?
They really are.
That's crazy. You can find me over at, you can find me here at Film School Rejects. You can also find me at oneofus.net, which is a site that I co-manage, and we do a lot of podcasts and articles over there. And I'm on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, I think is my official, pro page or whatever. Until next time, I just want to remind you guys that when setting out on a mission of revenge, first dig two graves, one for your enemy and one for the foot you lose to diabetes.